Oh, sure, your marketing types just walked in and said you need to port that system from that friendly old RTOS you're using to Linux. It should be a piece of cake, right? There's just a couple of details, like those unique devices in your system that don't have a Linux driver yet. Hey, don't worry. We are not from corporate, and we are actually here to help today. Hi, and welcome to everyone. This is Don Dingy, and I'm part of the editorial staff here at Open Systems Media. I'll be your moderator for today's program on migrating legacy RTOS device drivers to embedded Linux, sponsored by Monte Vista Software. Let's take a real quick look at our agenda first. After a bit of housekeeping to help you with today's experience, I'll have a couple thoughts. We'll hear from our expert guest in his presentation, and then we'll take your questions in a question and answer session. If you've been with us before, thanks for joining us again. Welcome back. This is a refresher. Just bear with me a bit. It's your first time with us. Thanks for joining us, and here's some tips for viewing this session. You are seeing slides on the right half of your screen, and if you'd like to see a larger view of those slides and some of the good stuff on them, just click that Enlarge Slides button. You can also download the slides we're using by clicking the Download button. You can invite a friend who should be watching this, and assuming you've shut off your pop-up blocker, you'll be seeing a short poll and a closing survey, which you can answer at your discretion today. We certainly appreciate your responses. And then there's an important box down on that left-hand side. There's Ask a Question. I'll be taking questions from what you submit for our Q&A session right after the presentation. So just type in that box and hit Submit Questions. So now that you can follow along with the bouncing ball, let's go ahead and get started. I will go on record immediately saying I did not say this quote at the top, but early in the Linux game, very early in fact, Linus did say that. Personally, I pined for the days when I had more time. And just for the record, I've worked with women who write perfectly good device drivers, but I think the point he was trying to make is it's not something to be terrified of if you do have to write a Linux device driver. There's certainly a lot of Linux device drivers out there already, but like a lot of OEM embedded systems, chances are you've got something unique in yours, and that old RTOS device driver has to be migrated somehow if you need to move over to a Linux system. So, you might be thinking right now, what did I just get myself into? Interesting. If you've never done a Linux device driver, it probably looks nothing like that RTOS you're using. We were actually having a discussion about there's some talk about POSIX-compliant device drivers, but it's kind of early in the standardization process. So I'll stand by that statement that your driver that you've got is probably really different from where you would end up on a Linux device. And there's a really good chance that the person that wrote that driver in your RTOS system has left the company, and nobody actually knows how that thing works now. It's just working. Don't touch it. But now, because of that marketing guy who thinks moving to Linux is easy, guess what? You've got to move that driver, and you can't certainly let a project stop because of that one driver. Now, can you? Like I said, we are here to help today, and I will bring on our first guest. My guest today is a longtime friend, Bill Weinberg, who's been in the embedded software business for a couple of decades and more recently has focused on the open source side. He's the brains behind LinuxPundit.com. He's also general manager for business development of the Linux Phone Standards Forum, also called LIPS. He has previous stops at Open Source Development Labs, Monte Vista Software, and other places on the embedded side. He's a prolific author and speaker. You're likely to see him at places like the Linux World Expo. Again, we are taking questions for Bill after the presentation, so submit your thoughts for our consideration. And Bill, it is all yours.
Thanks so much, Don. That's a very nice introduction. It's good to be working with you today. We have a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to dive right in. We're talking today about migrating legacy drivers. And I want to real quickly focus on our objectives and eliminate some of our non-objectives. So I'm really going to talk about the path from legacy to Linux today. I'm going to look at both the legacy technology and Linux technology and how you bridge between them. And hopefully I'll be providing some useful and actionable information that will make migration a lot easier. What I'm not going to do today is try to teach you how to write Linux or legacy device drivers. I think you'll learn a bit about that along the way if you haven't done so, but I don't claim to be the world's greatest expert on writing all device drivers. I know a lot about the architecture of the Linux kernel, and I certainly have my experience with legacy device drivers from the time I worked with other systems, different kinds of RTOSes. And I'm not going to try to cover every type of device driver, every type of legacy RTOS. We'll see in a moment where our focus is. The emphasis here, obviously, is on the migration and the challenges you'll face and some ways to meet those challenges without going insane. So our agenda today is to look at the landscape and where legacy is, what you're likely to find, where you're coming from, where you're going to, talk about the migration of the driver code and the I/O constructs. Your legacy OS may not even have anything resembling a formal driver infrastructure. We'll talk about the particular challenges and choices you have to make in that migration, and I'll point out some useful resources, both hard and soft resources that help companies migrate their code. And we'll briefly touch on what kind of return on investment you get before we wrap up. So diving right in, the decision tree that you face when you're looking at migration has a few twists and turns to it, but it's pretty straightforward. If you're looking at a legacy device, you have to ask yourself, what kind of support does it have and from whom already? Hopefully the answer isn't it's only supported by this one guy in our organization and he's or she is gone, which is what Don pointed out. But the concept here is that you might find a device already in the main Linux tree. You might find it supported on Linux from the supplier of the actual chipset that is implementing the I/O, or you might find it on another board vendor. If they have integrated that chipset or a related chipset onto a single board computer or a motherboard or a blade they're selling, they very well could be supporting it themselves with a Linux device driver. So before you dive right in and assume that you have all the work to do yourself, it pays to look around. Now, if a Linux device driver is not available, well, we can ask ourselves the question either way here. If it's not available, what you would end up doing is then making a decision between doing it yourself and outsourcing. If you're looking to outsource, well, there's lots of services organizations you could go to, certainly a Linux supplier like Montevista or other folks who are in this business. You could look at individual consultants. You could look at services organizations that do this as their core business. And there is something called the Linux Device Driver Project that I'll be describing a little later on in the presentation. If you, going back to our previous decision, if there is a driver available, you do have to make sure that that driver is up to date. It might be for an earlier major revision of the kernel, like it might exist for the 2.4 kernel instead of the current 2.6 family, or it may be a back rev within 2.6, in which case you have a much better chance of simply having it working, but you may have some work to do. Moving back out to the idea of doing it in-house, on the right side of our diagram, if you find yourself with an in-house migration project, which is sort of the ultimate terminus and the main focus of this presentation, then you're likely to have to make some tougher decisions about whether you're going to utilize an internal resource, whether you're going to do a hybrid kind of project where you're reaching out to some outside resources, the idea being that you end up with ultimately a migrated driver, but realize that through the rapid evolution of the Linux kernel, you might find yourself over time performing this task iteratively to keep that driver up to date. So we're going to focus on the area outlined in blue here, the internal migration process, but don't necessarily assume that you're on your own. There are a lot of useful resources out there, and like I said, I'll be pointing a few of them out along the way. Now, there are still a lot of legacy RTOSs and other embedded platforms in play. In 1992, I remember doing a trade study in which I identified around 320 named semi-commercial and commercial RTOS products. And I found myself, actually when I worked at Montevista, it was probably around 2001 or 2002, revisiting that study and finding that at least half of them were still out there commercially or in deployment. And certainly, if you look at this short list, you'll probably find the most popular ones. There's a wide, wide variety, though. Today's presentation, we're going to use probably the most popular embedded OS historically. We're going to focus on VxWorks. The constructs in VxWorks are fairly well understood. It's one of the better documented OSs, but even when you look at VxWorks as a body of code or a body of deployments, you have to make some decisions. And going back to the earliest deployments, remember back in from 1981 forward, actually, VxWorks was based on Jim Reddy's Vertex. In 1987, Wind came out with their own kernel, I believe written by Mr. Fogelman. And moving forward, we had a fairly standard deployment from 5.2 forward, which represents the majority of VxWorks deployments. And indeed, that's really where I'm focusing, is on the native VxWorks marketplace, mostly on VxWorks 5.0 and forward. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on VxWorks 6.0 constructs, which are really very different, and the deployments are much smaller historically. If you have some questions that are specific to that RTOS, or indeed to any of the other RTOSs we have mentioned in here, we'll take them offline and be happy to give you some insight as to how you migrate those particular types of device interfaces and constructs to embedded Linux. So typically, I'm sure you recognize this diagram, most RTOSs are constructed in inverted pyramid fashion, or at least application-wise, they grow to that construct over time, where you have a base RTOS with, in some cases, an abstracted board support package and formal or informal drivers running over the hardware. And as years go by, you put more and more code on top of it. And in fact, for the marketing people out there, this diagram certainly represents why a lot of people are moving to Linux. That inverted pyramid architecture can get very unwieldy and ultimately can fall over, in particular because classic embedded OSs were not designed to handle massive amounts of code and increasing amounts of functionality over time. I mean, they were some very good, very stable kernels, but they're lacking in services. Some, in fact, legacy RTOSs don't have native networking, don't have native file systems, and as you add more and more components, it becomes very difficult to migrate, which is one of the main motivations for moving to Linux. And these are relatively old architectures. Just the timeline from VxWorks shows you how old it is. Not that Linux is necessarily new, if you know the history of the Linux kernel, if you look at the history of Unix, but it certainly is today the dominant platform in the embedded space, and so you all have your individual motivations for migrating. The problem, going back to using this metaphor of the inverted pyramid, is that legacy RTOS device drivers, or I.O. code, can be peppered throughout the stacks that run in these RTOSs. Certainly, one would expect them to live near or inside the RTOS kernel, but they may actually be implemented physically in terms of where the code resides inside the networking layer, inside adaptation layers and middleware that people supply. They certainly could find themselves inside Java, inside graphics code, and probably the most distressing place I found actual I.O. code in legacy RTOSs is inside application code itself, although all of the other places have their own special charms, especially in figuring out where the code is if you're migrating or maintaining it, and being able to work on it and pry it loose if you need to abstract it. So the problem with this diffuse implementation of I.O. code certainly is that it's hard to reuse. It can be very tricky to debug. And if you do face this kind of coding practice, you're finding that it's hard to maintain. What you end up with also is a flying spaghetti monster kind of implementation where you have code sharing at a massive level. You don't have any particular separation architecturally, especially in terms of device libraries and a lot of legacy code, between driver code, kernel code, user application code. This is evidenced by the fact that a lot of RTOSs have calls in their native libraries, or at least macros, that return a value based on whether or not the context of execution is a device driver or an interrupt service routine or not, so that code that needs to be reentrant or code that simply needs to make decisions about interrupt masking or not can decide whether it's actually running an interrupt context. This would never happen in a Linux system. It's the separation between user space and system space is so distinct, you'd never have to ask that question. But just the fact that most RTOSs have APIs like this tells you something about the coding practice if you've never actually cracked open the code that implements it. And certainly this diffuse and confused context makes it harder to code at all, because you have to worry about reentrancy in places you probably wouldn't worry about it. You have to have coding practices, especially at an assembly level, especially if you're looking at preambles and codas to writing subroutines. And it's kind of annoying not to know your context a priori. It's just the people that are writing device drivers and the people that are writing other kinds of system code don't tend to be in the same room most of the time. So let's do a brief comparison architecturally, just the attributes that you have to worry about between a legacy OS and Linux as we make our way into the particulars of I/O code. Most legacy OSs, for example, don't have a process model, don't have full-blown POSIX process models, whereas Linux does. There are certainly legacy RTOSs that do. They can be Unix-type legacy RTOSs, or they can be memory-protected RTOSs that implement at least part of the POSIX model, but it's not real common, at least not for the majority of the code we're looking at today. And in fact, in most legacy RTOSs, the MMU is enabled only as a means to configure cache, and with regard to its other abilities to implement memory protection, it pretty much just dissipates heat. In terms of your addressing models, and this gets extremely important for both application and device code, most legacy RTOSs focus on physical addressing, whereas everything in Linux is virtually addressed, and we'll talk about that in a moment as well. And that includes the kernel. There is really nothing in the Linux model that is physically addressed once you get through the boot cycle. Now, having a formal device driver model sometimes is more for appearances than for actual implementation. A lot of legacy OSs don't have a device driver model that you would recognize, or if they have one, it's something that partners would use or the actual vendor would use, but in many cases their customers, you, the OEMs and other developers, were inheriting either an earlier legacy model or simply chose not to use the available model and wrote your code, as I've indicated, in interesting places. While there is a lot of possible use of user space I/O code in Linux, it's generally not the practice. It's a place to do debugging, and in some cases, there's some deferral mechanisms that let you run I/O code in user space. But in general, we have a complete and rich driver model in Linux compared to the variability of legacy OSs. And again, in a legacy OS, the interrupt service can and does occur in many different places, and well, there have been some very interesting experiments about interrupt latency in user space in Linux. The top half, the ISR and the top half of device drivers in Linux are realistically only implemented in kernel context in a driver. Now, when we talk about legacy OSs, when we talk about VxWorks in particular, we reference you've probably all seen this book. I have it sitting here on my desk, the 5.2 VxWorks Programming Guide. And the thing about legacy OSs, whether you're talking about VxWorks or others, is that they have hundreds of calls, and they don't make a strong distinction between kernel calls and other kinds of libraries. They're all kind of thrown together. You can distinguish based on which actual library you're looking at. In the case of VxWorks, well, there is kernel-lib, but to do real work, you probably have to reach out to several dozen other libraries, and I'm just talking about I/O, not the user space what we call in Linux user space libraries, the user application libraries, that things that are like libc. On one hand, this is very rich. On the other hand, what you're seeing here are APIs that have accrued over time that include these core APIs that have to do with kernel operations and scheduling and IPCs, and others that made their way into the set because of particular BSPs implemented, particular customer requests. It is a typical path, and it's a very, very rich API set. And certainly if you're coming from Windows, for example, you know that the Win32 API set is vast as well. And it's unlike talking about user space, when you're talking about porting at the kernel level, you're not usually presented with a set of standard APIs on either side. So your API translation strategies are not usually going to work with a driver you're looking at a fairly thorough recoding and re-architecting. So this formal appearance that you do have in some cases for legacy, VxWorks in particular actually does offer some formal driver APIs and entry points. It has the POSIX-like entry points of create, remove, open, close, read, write, and ioctl, and certainly you have most of those calls in Linux or some cases by slightly different names. And they plug very neatly into the Wind River BSP model. And it's certainly not a bad starting point if you have written your driver to conform to those basic entry points, especially for simple block and character I.O. You probably have a fairly straightforward job of moving that into the Linux model. You'll have to change the underlying APIs, but at least you have your code structured to service the major POSIX-type entry points at the top. What happened, though, I've seen over time, especially for non-block and character I.O. or non-traditional block and character I.O., especially network drivers and other things, is that you have I.O. code that doesn't conform to this model unless you are a partner, unless you had a formal reason to be doing it. And to some degree, we're going to be worrying about that in the next couple slides. The other issue you have to worry about also is that these legacy drivers, formal or informal, for VxWorks, PSOS, other legacy systems, in some cases they weren't even developed internally. In some cases they came from a board vendor or another third party, and it's quite probable you don't have source code for them. I went out and did a little nosing around in the last week or two just to see what the current state was. To see if I could point you folks to some legacy device driver code on the web, and there is some, but the majority of references, if you just go out and do a casual search, will be to prepackaged binary drivers for the legacy OS, which are much harder to migrate. So this ad hoc reality is a bit messier and presents some challenges. You'll have device drivers that reflect the particular coding standards, if any, of perhaps a hardware vendor, perhaps of predecessors in your organization or other third parties. There's also some unique I.O. schemes that are present in certain OSs. I mean, PSOS had its own set of I.O. classes that don't correspond to anything in any other OS that I know. Some of the newer VxWorks drivers have their own sets of I.O. classes and libraries that accompany it. And those are all, you know, not strictly speaking mappable. They're very much sui generis. You're on your own with some of them, and you're going to have to do some re-architecting. Another thing that I found in a lot of OEM experience is that they took the existing RTOS TCP/IP stack and networking infrastructure, and this was as true for VxWorks as for, which had a native TCP/IP stack going pretty far back. They integrated a version of BSD Lite. But it certainly is true for a lot of other RTOSes as well, that TCP/IP and Ethernet and other kinds of networking were bolted on after the fact, or not native, and it's pretty clear to see they're not native. And in order to get that stuff to work, or because you felt compelled at the time to get better performance or replace it, those stacks are not even present, and what you have is a hybrid of third-party code implementing your networking. And that can have its upside in that it's more cleanly separated and easier to pry apart and interface to a sockets library. In other cases, if you've interfaced, you know, very early NICs on unsupported devices, then you still have to go in and deal with the underlying driver whose architecture could be very different from the Linux drivers moving forward. And that can be true for other kinds of I.O. and I.O. subsystems where it's all wrapped up in an entirely proprietary layer that may or may not be source code available and may or may not port very easily. Now, if you're coming from a legacy RTOS and you're coming from one that is simply physically addressed, you're certainly going to be used to having the ability to address memory directly. I've certainly talked to a lot of developers of legacy systems who seem unhappy to have the MMU getting in their way from talking directly to physical devices, whether it's raw memory or a memory map device. It's simply it's too easy in a legacy RTOS to reach out and touch the hardware. And I remember having a discussion several years ago with a developer, and he was concerned that the MMU would be in his way. Now, there are MMU-less versions of Linux, certainly. UC or MicroC Linux is an example, but you're still going to follow the formal models to be talking to physical memory. I'll show you in a couple more slides the source code, at least for user space, on how to actually talk to physical memory. But realize that even when you're working in a device driver, even when you're working in kernel space, you're going to be addressing your devices as virtually addressed entities. You're going to have to acquire a translation that will yield a pointer to you with an MAP-type call, and you'll work with that pointer. It's not a big deal, but you're not going to be able to reach out and touch the memory the way you've been used to doing if you're working with a fairly simple legacy OS. A couple years ago, I wrote an article in Linux Journal on this topic to point out some of the challenges in migration. And the device driver model that I used in that article was one I'd seen fairly frequently, which is a producer-consumer model. And just to summarize, what you have in some legacy systems is, again, you have all your code running in system mode. And this is true for a very large number of legacy RTOSes, certainly for VxWorks, where the entire system was running essentially bare metal in system mode, didn't take advantages of the ring architecture or the protection architecture available in fairly modern silicon. And the rationale was that JSRs are faster than traps, and this was supposed to be running at the speed of bare metal whenever possible. Of course, the downside being that if you have all of your code, kernel, drivers, ISRs, application code in the same physical address space, it's highly, highly corruptible and led to a lot of debugging challenges and maintenance challenges that I'm sure you're all familiar with. And I/O code, as we indicated, can be all over the place. This blurring between system and application context is the cause of a lot of headaches. The architecture that we're seeing here involves I/O that's instigated through a particular call. It could be something like a read call. It could be that there is no explicit call after an initial setup or opening of the I/O channel, and that as interrupts occur, data is fed up through a queuing mechanism, and then the various tasks involved will be pulling data off of that queue. I've seen that architecture in one form or another for a lot of different types of applications. It's clean. It's easy to implement. There's some challenges in terms of synchronization, although they're no worse in an RTOS, than other kinds of synchronization. It's actually pretty straightforward. This is not exactly what you'd end up with in Linux. If we take this as a straw man and we look at what you end up with in Linux, you have a bit more formalism and a lot more separation. You have a very clean distinction between user mode and system mode and between user mode addresses and system mode addresses. We have a driver that is living in kernel space, whether it was originally instanced as a kernel device driver at build time or inserted later on as a module. And we actually are always going to be instigating at least once our I/O with a read call or an ioctl call to kick off the I/O, and then your driver as the part of its return sequence will be taking the results and writing them back into user space memory into a buffer usually that was supplied by the calling routine, a bit more formal. Ultimately, you're getting the same job done, but you have to do it in a more formal way. The big difference is that usually the synchronization of the calling routines and the arbitration among how to use the device is done implicitly by the OS, not something explicitly, although you have the option to intervene and change that architecture in your application and in your driver. So let's talk about moving some constructs here. Let's talk about the basic architecture. In a legacy OS, you have interrupt occurring. You enter into your ISR. Presumably, your ISR is actually handing off control to a driver. It may be a driver that has multiple pieces, that has a deferral mechanism. It may be a monolithic driver. When the driver's done, it may return directly into its calling context. It may pass off control to a scheduler. And it may be that it has instanced a deferral mechanism if the legacy OS has one. You know, the VxWorks has one. A lot of legacy OSs have one, at which point, depending on prioritization, the remainder of the I/O task might occur as a user task and not running essentially in kernel mode, even though the distinctions are very fine here in a legacy OS. But it's very linear. A lot of times you have real-time performance issues with the driver architecture, and I've certainly encountered my share of drivers where the interrupt context is maintained through the life of the driver, and all of the work that the driver has to do, especially for the most, ostensibly most important, highest priority I/O tasks, is performed right there in what I would call the top half of the driver, preempting by design, not through the system of prioritization, but simply preempting by getting there first and doing its work and letting go. And this is one of the harder kinds of drivers to extricate from the legacy environment, because the assumptions about prioritization, the assumptions about sharing the processor are fairly primitive. And once you pull this out and put it into a more general purpose architecture, you may find yourself with some performance challenges. And you also may find yourself tempted to keep this architecture in place in Linux, which I would advise against. In terms of the Linux architecture, the same flow of operation actually occurs, but there are many more mechanisms at your disposal for implementing your I/O, how and where the work occurs, how and where deferral occurs. So let's dive right in real briefly. So whether you're running in user space or previously were running in kernel space, you might have been in a driver, you might have been in the middle of a system call, when the interrupt occurs, just like with any other system, you have an interrupt service routine. The goal here is that it's short and sweet. The interrupt context continues to the top half of your driver, where your goal is essentially to quiet things down. Even in a legacy OS, ideally you don't want to be doing real work in the very first part of your driver, in the top half of your driver. Having gotten past that top half in Linux, you actually have a series of options available to you. In 2.4, before some of the mechanisms like SoftIRQ and Tasklets and user space I/O were current, and even in 2.6, you're not obliged to use these other mechanisms, you would proceed directly to the bottom half, or you would wait for the kernel to call the bottom halves, because what happens is that before the scheduler is called and after the kernel does other work is when bottom halves are typically executed, and they are executed in a traditional system in FIFO order, which is one of the contributors to the original challenge in Linux of delivering real-time performance, is that if you had real-time I/O to accomplish or needed to get back into a user space routine to respond to an I/O event in real-time, you had to sit in line in a FIFO queue waiting for the bottom half to execute before the scheduler was called. In order to repair that, there's a whole lot of different things that have happened. Some Montevista's contributed a lot of patches to make this a better world. But architecturally, with the introduction of the 2.6 kernel, there's several other mechanisms that make it a lot easier to give more responsiveness to your driver. One of them is the SoftIRQ, which essentially continues the processing of the ISR, but does so in a prioritizable fashion. It's not the best place to be continuing that. It's usually reserved for the core I/O in a system. Of course, this is your system. You get to decide what's in it in an embedded environment. In your typical desktop and server environments, it's usually your main disk and a few other devices that use the SoftIRQ architecture. The challenge with SoftIRQs is just like with physical IRQs, there are relatively few of them, and you have to reserve them for individual purposes, but they are there. More typically, or more recommendedly for most drivers, there are two other mechanisms to be looking at. One is that you have your top half schedule, using a standard kernel call, schedule the execution of deferred processing in a tasklet, which runs in kernel mode and then participates in scheduling before you return to user space. And the third option is to do I/O in user space. And that can be done informally, simply by providing the access to the particulars of your I/O operation to the user space routine, whether those are pointers to the devices or buffers, or simply the ability to chew on the data if it's purely a compute-bound operation. Or it might be doing I/O in a more formal sense in user space, especially if you're using one of two evolving user space mechanisms, which we'll get to, those being the USB interface and user space, that's USB lib, or the experimental work that's going on with user space I.O. Okay. So at this point, we have a poll question. I'd like to have you tell us a bit about your legacy OS. The legacy OSs we've called out here, there are four of them. Obviously, there are a lot more. And in fact, if your legacy OS doesn't appear here, please do send us email or give us some impressions through the question interface as to what your legacy OS is so we know how to fine-tune future webinars to meet the needs of real developers doing real coding. Moving along in the slides, I think you'll be seeing those polls in a pop-up window. In legacy systems, an area that comes up a lot are legacy networking drivers. There are not a lot of totally proprietary network interface chips or network interface cards. You might find yourself with one that's proprietary to your organization because of a special medium or a special protocol. The way networking worked inside VxWorks, whether you were dealing with a proprietary protocol or proprietary hardware or not, was to level those differences through a multiplexer or a MUX. So primarily this was developed to facilitate TCP/IP, and it fed upwards into a fairly normal TCP/IP stack, although over time the Berkeley stack that was originally integrated by the folks at WIND accumulated some Crofton particulars. And reaching downward into a driver model with that the MUX had, and it's actually fairly easy to find out what the callbacks in the MUX. There's a lot of documentation for this on the web, or you probably have some yourself. This architecture does and doesn't port to Linux. It's not the worst starting place. Certainly the fact that there is some formalism in the legacy VxWorks MUX will help you out. The next slide here describes the basics of the Linux networking architecture. And while it looks a lot more complicated, you have a lot of the same callback principles as you do with the APIs. Realize that if you weren't using a sockets library, you're probably going to be using a sockets library with Linux. You have a TCP/IP stack that, as I indicated, shares in heritage with VxWorks and a lot of other RTOSes, in that it is based on the Berkeley stack. It is originally based on BSD 4.4 or BSD Lite, but the resemblance ends there. They've both been in situ, that is, the Linux TCP/IP stack and the RTOS TCP/IP stacks for a long time. The exact nature of the APIs I call out here in the network driver interface, this diagram was put together actually early in the life of 2.6, and some of this has changed. I'm working on updating this diagram, which I'll be doing when we issue the white paper around this topic. There's plenty of example device drivers. I mean, that's the good news with Linux, is that you can reach out and find plenty of examples to work from. But this is just to give you an idea of the architecture. There's some interesting routines that you also want to be looking at in the skbuf family of files in the Linux kernel that have to do with the buffer management. Long topic. We have only a limited amount of time. Be happy to answer some questions about this on or offline. So importantly, is if you're looking at migrating a legacy driver or writing a new one from scratch for Linux, is understanding the APIs available to you as a programmer. And certainly you want to understand the ways to access the kernel APIs and the architectures that are implicit in the Linux driver design. Biggest split up front is between static linkage, as kernel drivers that are built together with the kernel when the kernel is created, versus those which are linked dynamically and are available to modules. A module is a mechanism in Linux for inserting functionality into the kernel post-boot at runtime. Most modules are drivers, but they don't have to be. There are security code. There's whole subsystems that are built as modules. It's just for most discussion you'll hear modules as containers for device drivers. And there's a big difference in the – well, there's two big differences between doing this with modules and doing your drivers statically. One is that with static drivers you have the entire kernel symbol set at your disposal because you're living in the same namespace, whereas with a module, you only have access to symbols which have been exported. You can see the symbols that you have access to in a 2.6 kernel in the proc interface. I'll show you that in a moment. There are certain tricks to using these symbols. Especially, you should realize that the symbols available to a module are very much kernel-specific, and you're not going to be able to bind a module to a version of the kernel that it was not created for. So if you're going to be working with a module interface, you have to be building your drivers for the particular kernel you're deploying and updating that module as you update your kernel. The APIs that we're talking about for the module are in proc kallsims. In 2.4, that was ksims. And I just pulled up a couple different systems I had to show you the number of symbols that are in these interfaces. I have a small appliance running built on 2.6.19, and the allsims interface there, when enabled for debugging, this is full debugging symbols, had over 28,000 symbols, and I have a Fedora Core desktop that had, you know, over 40,000 symbols. If you build your kernel not for debugging and you're stripping out other symbols, then this number is a lot smaller. Not all of those are really there for your driver. Don't get too scared. There's actually a much smaller number that your driver is likely to use, and they're documented in some references I'll provide shortly. The APIs to use are fairly straightforward, and in fact, you can go looking for analogs for the individual calls that exist with your RTOS. And in fact, if you, in your driver, in your RTOS, were using what look like CZIP kind of symbols and had very comparable user space implementations, in many cases, you'll find analogs in the kernel prefixed with K. So not malloc, but kmalloc, and et cetera, down the line. And they are broken into a series of subsystems, so it is parsable. The challenge is that they're not all documented in one place. There's not a definitive guide. The best thing to do for writing device drivers here is to start looking at existing ones of a class that resemble your device, although there's some IP issues there we're not going to get into right now. The definitive works are, for example, Rubini's device driver book and a few others that will give you insight into this, but there's not like a single blue book for the Linux kernel interface. Now, I'll get to the interface question in a second. As I mentioned before, you're going to be writing your drivers to access the physical I.O. using virtual addressing. I provided here on this slide an example, actually, of doing this in user space. One of the things I recommend you start out with, instead of plunging straight into the kernel, is take some of your code. If you just want to do a quick and dirty and see if you can get things to run at all, you can even take some of your legacy code and run it as a user space application and see if you can get it to talk to the I.O., see if you can get it to work. It's probably not going to have optimal timing or performance, but you can test out some of the interfaces pretty quickly. And moving right along, talk about some of the challenges we face. I referred a minute ago to some of the issues around the kernel API, and it's one of the most important points for you. Realize that very early on in the history of Linux, Linus pledged that user programs could depend on the API stabilities, principally through the system call interface and through libraries like stdlib and glibc. And there would be good continuity. Indeed, that promise has been kept very well. But he also promised that kernel developers would be free to innovate and do as they wanted in kernel space. And that's meant that there's been a decent amount of innovation, rev to rev, whether it's a major rev like 2.2 to 2.4 to 2.6, or even minor revs within the 2.6 family. Sometimes kernel APIs can change because the kernel developers have the freedom to change them to make a better, fresher, newer versions of the kernel. And this is one of the things that forces drivers and modules to be specific to a kernel version. It's a much bigger issue, as I mentioned before, for modules than it is for kernel drivers. And this is why early on in that flowchart I indicated you do have some need for even aligning legacy Linux drivers with the new versions of the kernel you're working with. It does create a lot of tension. I've been on some panels and seen developers get up and ask tough questions of the kernel developers. The view from the kernel development community is when embedded developers don't move forward with the kernel because they don't want to move their device drivers, that they are somehow porting their code and being overly conservative and not sharing with the community. And the OEMs have a mirror image of this same issue, and that is that the community is refusing to let them future-proof their drivers so that they don't have to do a review when they move forward through major and, in some cases, minor revs of the kernel. So your best practices here, whether you're writing modules or even writing static drivers, is only to use exported symbols, which tend to be much longer lived. Work with community if you possibly can. If you can possibly get a driver into the kernel tree, or work with partners who can as proxies, so that the device driver maintenance work is not something you're doing all by yourself. And increasingly, people are building code, especially deferred code in user space, which has a much more stable API set. And I would also encourage you to do some lobbying, whether it's with the kernel developers themselves or through the Linux Foundation. I certainly do my share of getting up and annoying the kernel developers in public about the challenges that the view is not everyone thinks about the kernel the way they do. So in terms of drivers implemented as kernel drivers or modules, you have some choices to make. There's certainly pragmatic decisions about how big the kernel is. So kernel drivers impact the size because the source code lives in the kernel and it impacts the boot image. If you want a smaller boot image, you're likely to build your driver into a module. But realize that that means that the device is not available at boot time until you insert the module. Certainly there's a difference in the APIs, although that's not a huge issue. And there is a licensing issue between whether your driver is going to be GPL or whether it's going to be something else. In general, the wisdom is that if you're putting a driver into the kernel, it's going to be GPL. It's the code is put together. Whether or not it's a derived work is a question for lawyers, but there are no non-GPL drivers that are in the kernel itself. Certainly, though, there are a lot of modules wandering around in source and binary that are not GPL, and that is a long and complex debate I am not going to partake of here. If we look at the status legally, the drivers are not protected, as it were, by the exceptions granted by Linus in the copying, the original kernel license. And a lot of people refer to an email that he wrote where he says there's nothing in the kernel license that allows modules to be non-GPL, and people get all agitated about that. But at the same time, there's nothing in the kernel license that obliges them to be GPL either. And so everyone kind of makes their own call. You also have people like Greg Crowell Hartman, one of the kernel maintainers and someone who's very important in the driver development community, who's gotten up in public and said binary modules are illegal, which is an interesting statement but carries no particular weight because that would imply that there is statutory law applying. Essentially, your licensing issues are going to be the same here as they are anywhere else. If you're not creating a derived work by definitions that meet you and your lawyer's definitions of copyright law, then you're not obliged to worry about licensing your code under GPL. Different topic. Idea here is to follow some best practices. Obviously, if you possibly can, license your drivers as GPL. If you can't, ship your drivers as binary modules instead, or migrate your code into user space where it's not an issue as much as you possibly can, and put code in the kernel that you find that you have the freedom to make available. The diagram on this slide is one that I've shared many times over the years and kind of schematizes what I just said in one place. I've seen a lot of developers with versions of this diagram taped up to their cubicle walls. One of the real challenges you have with driver development is debugging and dealing with virtual addressing. Realize that at boot time, for the very beginning of booting, you are running in physical address space. And after you turn on the MMU, of course, everything is virtual. This physical virtual dichotomy, I mean, exists in some legacy RTOSes, but it creates some interesting challenges. It creates challenges if you haven't locked down all your pages in terms of finding out whether a page is mapped in or not and finding the data in it. It means that your breakpoints are actually offset from their physical addresses by the address of the base of the page. This is especially tricky if you're using ICE or JTAGs, although for kernel debugging, there has been some enablement points, sort of a post to calculate that offset in the kernel for many, many years, and most of the JTAG vendors already have the ability to deal with a Linux kernel. And the good news is at the kernel level, the driver level, your addresses are contiguous. The pages are all laid out in contiguous RAM because the kernel was instanced in empty RAM when it booted up, so you don't at least have to worry about disparate pages. Shared libraries are another item if you're dealing with system debugging or debugging all the way up through user space, of course, because they can have different addresses as different processes talk to them. Something else you'll find a little bit different between legacy OSs and Linux is that there's no such thing as kernel awareness. Most of the debuggers out there look at the kernel as though it were an application, a single address space, a single large program. If you're familiar with things like Prism Plus, Rapisos Plus, or some other debuggers that actually understood the internal constructs, you're not going to find that with Linux, which makes device driver debugging a little harder. It means you have to have more knowledge of the internal constructs of the kernel that your driver is using. It's just one of the charms of moving forward to Linux. There's a lot, however, a lot of tools available to you. Certainly you can even look at the proc file system to begin familiarizing yourself with some of the constructs without actually cracking open the kernel source code. If you want to look at the way your application is working, there's the Linux Trace Toolkit and the next generation of Linux Trace Toolkit. And in fact, that forms the basis of some of the commercial tools. For example, MontaVista DevRocket takes advantage of LTT, and there's some tools from some other folks. So real quickly, on the resource side, there are both technical and human resources for migration. There are API toolkits that do translation, although their usefulness in the driver space is somewhat limited. I'm talking about things like MapUware from MapUware's OS Changer. There are some driver abstraction tools, but they require that you write your drivers to yet again another set of APIs that is relatively OS independent. For example, WinDriver is an example. There's a way of using virtualization that's being touted by the virtualization vendors where instead of actually writing your drivers as native entities, you have what's called a lightweight execution environment. This is one of the guest machines of your hypervisor, and you put your drivers down in that, and then you have an abstracted or theoretically universal interface to your driver, and you never actually have to port it, but you still have to port it to the APIs available in the virtual machine architecture. If you want to learn more about that, talk to people like Open Kernel Labs or VirtualLogix, or for that matter, VMware has an architecture like that as well. Then there are a number of open source projects and other technologies. There's a very interesting project called Vita Linux, which is sponsored by MontaVista, and a lot of that information is also on the MontaVista website. There is an updated version independent of Vita Linux called Vita Lin, which is out there as a SourceForge project. If you're coming from Windows or a Windows-compatible system, you can use the NDisWrapper mechanism. This is for primarily for network drivers, and encapsulate a Windows network driver, Windows-compatible network driver, and have it run under Linux. Interesting resource. It's also, it may be a way, if there isn't a Linux driver and you only have a legacy driver, but there is a Windows driver, you can pick it up and use it in the NDisWrapper environment rather than having to write your own. And then, of course, there are the user space device drivers. There is a project called the User Level Device Drivers for Linux project, or Gelato, but it's not mature. I wouldn't go and build a high reliability embedded device on it, but it is an interesting experiment. You might want to go look at that. And if your device is a USB device, well, the USB library is now mainstream, and you can build on that with no problem. There is the Linux Device Driver Project run by Greg Croa Hartman, same fellow who said that modules were illegal. He's a huge vested interest in drivers and in the kernel. Very good guy. I used to work with him in my involvement with the Linux Foundation and the Open Source Development Lab. I would recommend visiting this project. They will take up the cause of writing device drivers and putting them into the kernel, but just because you ask doesn't mean they're going to build your driver for you or do your work for you. You kind of have to show that your need is ubiquitous. I referred briefly before to the Rubini text, and in fact, in the latest version for the 2.6 kernel, Greg joins the team as one of the authors. There's a lot of different options for professional services. Certainly, your distribution supplier, toolkit supplier is a place to go, and other kinds of individual service providers and integrators. Just remember that I think you've already learned from this webinar that migrating drivers is not generic programming, not generic consulting, and there's some very specific expertise your service supplier or internal resource will need to have. And just trying to wrap up here so we can get to the Q&A, I think that the overall benefits of migration are probably well known to this audience in terms of control and cost and scalability. The migration from your legacy, you're probably doing it well for reasons to modernize, reasons to migrate to new hardware, but you want to preserve your investment as much as possible, and you want to try to keep yourself from being locked into a single supplier. There are very good suppliers out there. And you want to bring your application forward so that it can take advantage of the mainstream capabilities in Linux and certainly ease migration forward with new versions of Linux or even other OSs. And to conclude, it's a real investment. This is a non-trivial operation. It's a different kind of investment from migrating your applications forward. It can be that you're stuck on a single interface. It's more likely that you have a number of interfaces to worry about, and you're going to need to capture a variety of legacy entities, whether it's the code or the technologies, or most importantly is the native knowledge in your organization, or knowledge may no longer be in your organization. And certainly there are the challenges that we've covered in terms of designing best practices and the need to throw out some of the legacy infrastructure that you might have had. And also, you may need to retrain or hire some new folks to make this transition happen smoothly. But it is a great opportunity for optimization, for improving performance, for reducing fragmentation. I think it's the greatest opportunity, though, to save costs and to work with a community-based development model, which you probably haven't done in the past, and join with the mainstream for both embedded and even enterprise computing. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Hey, we are to the audience participation for the program, and I wanted to indicate that we're bringing in Brad Dixon, who is Director of Product Management from MontaVista. Unlike the other two of us, he's a recovering applications engineer, and he's seen more than a couple of device drivers, too. Wanted to try to take at least a couple questions. I know we've gotten a few from the audience, and we've got time for maybe three here, so wanted to start by throwing this out to Bill and Brad in that order. This is an interesting question. It might be pretty open-ended, but what is, in your experience, what do you see as the biggest problem where people trip up on these migration efforts from RTOSes to Linux? Is there a single area that jumps out at you as the biggest problem?
Well, the biggest problem, real briefly, and I want to defer to Brad on some of this, is simply the architectural differences between legacy code, as I've mentioned. It's just their shapes are so different, the practices are so different, you don't know where to begin, and the lack of documentation for a lot of legacy devices, so that not only are you moving to an unknown, relatively unknown new environment, you're coming from an unknown legacy environment.
The dearly departed problem, yes. Brad?
Somewhat like Bill's answer, I think the hardest problem is developers just understanding their own implementation and what to migrate over to Linux and in what order. Once they've partitioned up their device driver needs, there are literally thousands of example device drivers to look at in the Linux kernel. It's typically not hard to find one like what you need to build and then model after that. I'd say the second biggest issue is just picking vendors that are uncooperative or have a Neanderthal view of what it means to support Linux.
I got an interesting one here, and this might be a couple seconds of debate. This is mostly for Bill from the sound of it, but back in 02, Linus said he really wasn't interested in making device drivers look like user level, but I think there's some good reasons to make user level drivers. Did he really mean that for embedded space, or is that a worthwhile debate, whether you want to be kernel level or user level in a driver?
Well, Linus isn't directly involved in the user level device driver project, and he is actually pleased with the fact the USB subsystem made its appearance. What I think he's saying is that this pressure for future-proofing drivers and for making writing device drivers more like writing user space applications, he was trying to express the fact that he's not particularly sympathetic to that he still holds by his earlier statements of preserving the device driver interface as a space for innovation in the kernel development community. and that he doesn't want to provide the same guarantees that are provided in the copying or the commitment to stability in the kernel so the kernel can evolve faster. He saw that the ossification, the fossilization of interfaces as something he wanted to prevent in the kernel architecture. And so all he's really saying is he's not going to do that. He doesn't take a different view of embedded versus enterprise code. I mean, a long time ago, Linus was quoted as saying embedded was, I think the term he used was cute. Today, he sees a lot of the more interesting activities being in embedded, and in fact, that's evidenced by the fact that Linus and Andrew together have nominated an embedded kernel maintainer, someone to represent the interests of the embedded systems community in the evolution of the Linux kernel. But this is one point where I don't think he's going to move very far in terms of standardizing that interface as much as we'd all like him to.
Now, this is a wrap-up question for both of you here. There's a couple flavors of this question. Does performance go up or down when migrating to Linux? Does networking throughput, which might have been disappointing on a legacy OS, get any better in Linux? Could you make a general comment? I know that's a your mileage will vary type of a question, but maybe you've got some ideas there. We'll start with Bill.
Yeah, the answer is yes. There's actually some benchmarks in some white papers that I helped co-author with Monta Vista over the years, both when I worked there and subsequently. The networking is a great place to look. A lot of RTOS vendors have so-called deterministic networking and have very impressive benchmarks for throughput, but they tend to do this for very small packets. And if you look at the benchmarks, whether it's NetPerf or an internal benchmark, you'll tend to find that as packets get larger and the overall necessity of throughput gets higher, you find that RTOS networking breaks down and isn't good at marshaling data, isn't good at moving large packets through the stack or out the networking port, which is where Linux is. So for very small packets, trivial benchmarks, Linux performance will appear to go down. But for more true-to-life loads and networking throughput, Linux has huge advantages, and it's been tuned by its use in enterprise to reach that point. For other kinds of I/O, your mileage will vary, but it's at least comparable.
Brad, any closing thoughts on that same question?
One common situation I see is that while there are standard interfaces for doing all sorts of typical Linux device drivers, and those are best to be followed in almost every case, it is an operating system that is delivered a source. There's not a reason that you can't, if you find it's necessary, implement an optimization which makes a particular piece of hardware, I/O, performance, really seeing. We've seen some of this happening with some of our multi-core network processing partners out there who do introduce customizations to the kernel that specifically exploit their hardware. So it is a hard question to answer in general, as everybody correctly identified. I think in general people see networking and block I/O performance dramatically improve. Certainly the I/O layers are far more intelligent than what you typically find in a feature-limited RTOS. And if you run to the end of your rope, there is an avenue for customization and optimizing that performance with Linux.
Okay, everyone. Appreciate all the material we got. By the way, some of the questions that came in, Monta Vista may be following up with you personally. There's a couple detailed issues here coming in at the last minute, but we need to sign off for this afternoon. We've just heard about migrating legacy RTOS device drivers to embedded Linux from our expert guests, Bill Weinberg from LinuxPundit.com and Brad Dixon, who participated with our Q&A from Monta Vista. Big thanks to both of them for sharing their expertise with us. This event and other ecasts are archived at the URL shown on your screen. These archived ecasts can be replayed at your convenience. We'd certainly appreciate hearing how we did with today's program. You're welcome to contact us at the email address shown. Thanks, as always, to our broadcast manager, Christine Long, who does incredible stuff to make sure everything and everybody shows up in the right place. And thanks to all of you out there for being with us today. Please join us again on behalf of our guests and all of us here at Open Systems Media. This is Don Dingy saying stay safe, be well, and we'll see you again soon.